6 minutes after 1 o'clock, and it's Monday. It's also the last couple of days of the month of March. Hey, it's going to hit like close to 80 on Tuesday. How about that, huh? Is that cool or what?
No, that's warm, Rick.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's okay.
That's a good thing.
Well, not all, but I'm looking forward to it. What about you, but about time. Anyway, coming up at 4 o'clock, Samara Lynn, PCMagazine.com business analyst, going to talk about tips for filing your taxes online. And, you know, there's a lot of programs out there you can get. Some of them good, some of them not so good. And, of course, everybody's worried about privacy. We're going to talk about all about that coming up at 4 o'clock with Samara Lynn. So if you haven't done your taxes yet and you're thinking about doing it online, well, stick around. She'll tell you how this is done right. And Gabriel Walensky, Anti-Semitism Roots and Development of How Christian Anti-Semitism Paved the Road to the Holocaust, and Where Does It Leave Us Today as We Speak. So Gabriel Walensky will be with us coming up momentarily. Well, speaking of history, we're going to talk about something that did Christianity play any role in the millennial or the millennium long or millennias of hatred toward Jews that led to the paroxysms of murder known as the Holocaust? 6 million crucifixions, how Christian anti-Semitism paved the road to the Holocaust, which, of course, he said, what could have possibly motivated ordinary Germans and their helpers throughout Nazi-occupied Europe, and, of course, long before that, obviously, to hate Jews so much, to drag thousands to die, shoot them in the head, close range, getting blood and other gore splattered all over after each victim, to continue to do it all day long, day after day. He's been studying this, by the way, for years, looking into the question of why the Holocaust happened. Gabriel Walensky, good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you so kindly for being with.
Sure.
First of all, the roots of anti-Semitism, at least in Germany, go back to the, well, certainly to the Middle Ages, don't they?
It goes way before that, actually. The anti-Semitism as a movement, if you will, as a hatred, originates right after the death of Jesus. So it precedes the Middle Ages by about 1,000 years or so.
You say, when the time in those days, that was Gaul during Jesus' time, and it was during the time of Rome. Were they even aware of the Jews then?
Oh, absolutely. During Judea, which was the name of the province that today is Israel, was a province of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, well, they called it Palestina.
Well, actually, it was called Judea, and it was later turned into Palestina when the Roman Empire fought the Jews in the Jewish War.
70 AD, yeah.
Exactly. Well, that was during that time, and that was the year when they destroyed the Second Temple in Jerusalem. The Jewish people at the time were causing so much trouble, and that war lasted for so many years that the Romans decided to obliterate pretty much the memory of the Jews. And one of the things they did was change the name of the province. So they changed from Judea to Palestina.
Yeah, and which is what was Roman or Latin, Roman Latin for Philistines.
It actually comes from there, yes.
Yeah, they just did it to just rub them the wrong way, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as the Germans, the Gauls, I mean, I don't know how much they would have known about the Jews or Judea or Palestina until the Roman diaspora.
Well, in Germany, just like in Gaul, in what was later France, and other places in Europe, the Jews started to come to all these places after the destruction of the Second Temple. They basically start to go to all kinds of places in the Roman Empire, and of course, Roman Empire was everywhere in Europe, including Germania,
it's
Germany.
Right.
So they started to establish themselves in all these different places. And the peoples that lived in these various places had knowledge of the Jews as a very tiny minority that lived amongst them. And it never really grew, and it never really was a sizable community. Yet the hatred that started to originate in all these countries, in Germany and other places, had to do more with the fact that in most of these places, of course, were Christian countries after the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachings that were preached by Christianity at the time were basically what caused this hatred, because they actually tried to distance themselves. The Christians tried to distance themselves from the Jews early on in the movement of the Christian movement. And by doing that, they instilled this notion that Jews were evil and that Jews were different and they had to be segregated and separated from the Christians. So this movement actually originates early on after the Roman Empire and, of course, it grew like a snowball until it became real hatred, violent hatred towards the Middle Ages.
Yeah, and I was going to say the violence, the Middle Ages probably would be a good place to take a look at where it was overt, wasn't it?
Definitely. As a matter of fact, in the First Crusade in 1096, when the First Crusade erupted, it swept Europe. It basically went from France and Germany all across Europe, and it went into the Holy Land with the intent of liberating the Holy Land from the yoke of the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, keep in mind that the main idea behind the crusade was to liberate the Holy Sepulchre and to basically liberate the land where Jesus had walked and where he lived and where he died. So, in the mind of this mob, most of which was made out of peasants and just common folk, some nobles and kings, but most were common folk and mostly ignorant. And in the mind of all these people who were going to liberate the land where Jesus had lived and died, they were also, in a way, thinking of taking revenge and taking revenge on the Jews, because in their mind, the Jews had been responsible for killing Christ. So this mob went on a killing rampage. In essence, they went with a war cry, baptism of death. So when they reached the various different towns in Europe, mostly along the Rhine in Germany and other places, they encountered the Jewish communities there, and they basically told them, you know, convert or die. And the Jews were not willing to convert, so most of them died in a very horrific way.
By the time we get in towards, say, the 18th century, or perhaps even 17th century, how well established was this anti-Semitic kind of feeling? I mean, by this time, having been almost institutionalized, was it around about that time where the church had established itself well enough throughout all of Europe that this whole notion of the Jew being the enemy of Christ, was it already well cemented by then?
It was very cemented by them. I would say that by the Middle Ages, in the time of the Crusades, the 11th century, 12th century, that hatred was fully established and fully cemented. There was no person, pretty much, in Christendom who did not hate the Jews, because it was actually preached commonly by in sermons and it was, of course, in the holy texts. In Christianity, you know, from the New Testament onwards, the books written by the church fathers and others, they actually had anti-Semitism written all over it. So over them. So you know, by the 12th century, and of course onwards, yes, anti-Semitism was very, very well established, and there was no doubt in the mind of anyone in Christendom that Jews were evil, and there were many times they considered them to be even minions of the devil and responsible for all the ills of the world, and so on. So yes, by the time the 17th century came around, the French Revolution, certainly, and the Enlightenment, and so on, sometime after that, the hatred was fully established, and as a matter of fact, found itself transformed by all these new ideas and by the new movements of the Illustration and the French Revolution.
All right, hold on a second, Gabriel. I'm going to take a quick break here. We'll pick it up where we left off.
Sure.
303-713-8585, the number. Gabriel Walensky, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Anti-Semitism Paved the Road to the Holocaust. And, of course, by that time when Hitler came to power, but I suppose Hitler was the one that created almost an industrial-sized anti-Semitic response. 303-713-8585, the number, 19 minutes after 1 o'clock. I'm Rick Barber as we continue on News Radio 850 KOA. Gabriel doing it tonight. 41 degrees going on out there. It feels warm. Feels pretty nice. It's actually very nice. We're going to get hot today, though. Tuesday's going to get up close to 80 in the upper 70s. People are talking anywhere around from 76 to 79 degrees. How about that? Going to be mostly clear and just warm. Very much like spring as it should be. Back again, we're talking with Gabriel Walensky, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Anti-Semitism Paved the Road to the Holocaust. Another thing, during the Middle Ages, especially during the age of the Black Plague, which is what, the 14th century?
That's right.
Yeah. A lot of the flagellants, the ones that went around beating themselves with whips as they travel all over Europe trying to get everybody to repent. One of the things that they thought were part of the problem was that the reason why this was God's wrath was because of the Jews. It would seem to me that already by that time, anti-Semitism had already been well established.
Correct.
How far back? I mean, you say it goes all the way back to the period of the Roman diaspora, but of course, by that time, they hadn't been there long enough for anybody to know who or what they were anyway. When did it really become an issue? What, by the 5th or 6th century?
Well, Christianity was established officially as the religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century by Emperor Constantine.
Yeah, and then he went and moved to the Eastern Empire.
Basically, but in essence, before then, Christianity was a small sect and that originated, of course, in Judaism.
There was a Jewish sect, too.
There was a Jewish sect.
Yeah.
Jesus was a Jew, and the apostles were Jews. And for the beginning, it was a Jewish sect. And initially, what happened was that this sect, of course, believed that Jesus was the Messiah, but mainstream Judaism did not.
Mm-hmm.
Jews, in general, did not accept that Jesus was the Messiah. This, of course, created some strife between this sect and mainstream Judaism. And, you know, like in any other case of strife, there's always going to be animosity, and people are going to find all kinds of nasty things to say about each other and so on. So what began as an inter-Jewish sect strife snowballed into something much bigger. Again, going back to the 4th century, Emperor Constantine makes Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, and at that point, the floodgates are open for hatred. You know, even before then, when the New Testament books were written, they were written with a very clear political and educational agenda, and one of the objectives that the writers of the Gospels and other books had was to distance themselves from Judaism. And there were many reasons for this. One of the reasons was that they had to they tried to basically proselytize among the Roman Empire, among the Romans and the various different Gentiles outside of Judea, outside of the Jewish community. And in order to do this, in order to make friends, if you will, with the Romans, they had to basically diminish the role of the Romans in the crucifixion and to blame the Jews. Also keep in mind that during the time of the first century, the Romans, again, were fighting the Jews. They fought the Jews in two main wars. The Jewish war during the year 66 all the way to 73. That, of course, included the destruction of the temple in the year 70. And then again in the 140, they fought the Second Judean War. So the Roman Empire was really sick and tired of the Jews at the time. So this sect basically had to find a way to tell the Romans, hey, we are not the same guys. You know, those guys, those pesky Jews, we are not the same kind of people. So they tried to distance themselves from the Jews by telling the Romans that they were different, that the Christianity was a different thing that had superseded Judaism and so on. So over time, this actually grew. And by the time of the Emperor Constantine and shortly after, the so-called church fathers, St. John Chrysostom, St. Augustine, Abelard, and St. Anselm, others, wrote many, many very important books for Christianity. As a matter of fact, these are the books that make up the foundation of Christianity as we know it today. Many of the dogmas and many of the things written there are still used by Christianity today. And some of these things were virulently anti-Semitic. You know, St. John Chrysostom wrote things that are quite similar to the tone and to the subject matter to what the Nazis were writing in terms of the hatred for the Jews.
Hitler, and clearly he was building on what I would say would be a kind of institutionalized emotion that had already been in Germany and again, well established. Was it Germany that was the most virulent of the European anti-Semitic movement, or they were just the first to show it in such a fashion?
Well, they were certainly the worst, if you will. But most of the European countries were anti-Semitic. But you're correct. When Hitler came to power, he found a population that was very receptive and ready to receive his message of hatred. And the reason why is because these people were already haters of Jews. Most of the German population, most of the other countries in Europe that the Germans eventually conquered, France, Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, all these other places, which happened to have Christianity as the common denominator, all these places already hated Jews for various reasons. Most of these places hated Jews for theological reasons. The Nazis, of course, were the hatred for the Jews that the Nazis had was predicated on the notion of racism and superiority of the Aryan race to the Jewish race. And other things. So it was not theological, but it was based upon the foundation that Christianity had set. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting quote that that I can give you. There was a guy called Roberto Farinacci, and he was a member of Mussolini's fascist Grand Council. In 1939, in giving a speech about the Church and the Jews, he said, and I'm reading, I'm quoting, "It comforts our souls to know that if, as Catholics, we became anti-Semites, we owe it to the teachings that the Church has promulgated over the past 20 centuries." So here we have, in a way, a summary of what we were just saying. And it's also a summary, in a way, of the content of the of my book, 6 Million Crucifixions, because here we have this fellow who is admitting openly that the reason why it's okay to be an anti-Semite is because, as a Catholic, you know, they absorbed and imbibed these teachings from the Church for the previous 20 centuries. And, you know, again, going back to Germany, as you were mentioning, when Hitler came to power, he, of course, was talking about the Jews in very negative terms, but he was actually building upon a foundation that was already there. And the population of Germany, and later, of course, Poland, Ukraine, France, and other places, were so willing and so receptive to this message, so willing to commit atrocities. And the reason why was because they already had this notion that Jews were evil and that they were bent on defiling the Christian mind and conquering the world and destroying the world economy and revolution and all these other things. And the reason why this was the case was because this, again, was built on the teachings that Christianity had spread for centuries before, that the Jews were guilty of killing Christ and guilty of poisoning wells and bringing the Black Plague and other things of that nature. So it was quite easy, as a matter of fact, for Hitler to persuade the German population to act the way they did, because he could have actually told them anything about the Jews, and they would have accepted it. You know, the German population, just like the Poles and the Ukrainians and others, would have accepted anything about the Jews that conformed with the ingrained notion that they already had about the Jews, which was, again, that they were hateful and so on.
Now, I can understand, the fervently religious, and I can understand those who have an animus against a group or a philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see plenty of it already.
Sure.
But I can't imagine the average German citizen suddenly just going completely bonkers. What happened?
Well, it wasn't really so sudden in reality. It was actually a very gradual process. And again, you know, the culmination of the process, which is the explosion that we saw in World War II, was really the culmination of many centuries of preparation that had happened before. Keep in mind that the people that the perpetrators during the war, you know, the soldiers, the 20-year-old soldiers that went on the killing rampages on the Eastern Front and other places, the people that pulled the machine gun, they pulled the trigger on the machine guns and they operated the gas chambers and so on, these people were the offspring or at most the grandchildren of people who had lived and seen the ghettos that the Church had established. You know, in 1870, the ghetto in Rome still existed and came down shortly after when Italy was liberated. So the grandparents of these people were alive at the time. That means that the perpetrators of the Holocaust heard either firsthand from their parents or from their grandparents all this stuff about what the Jews were doing and what the Church was doing to the Jews. They had seen it firsthand.
What was the spark that made the Holocaust possible?
Well, there were many reasons for it. When the Nazis actually came to power, they found themselves in a situation that was quite unique. Germany had lost the First World War. They had the Treaty of Versailles that was quite humiliating to Germany. There was a horrible economic depression. The Soviet Union, you know, there was a revolution in the Soviet Union. Communism was taking hold there. So there were many, many factors that were conspiring to make Europe at the time a powder keg. When Hitler came to power, he, of course, came from an environment that was anti-Semitic. He was a Catholic, too, by the way, and he lived and died a Catholic. And he had absorbed this theologically based notions about Jews that we were discussing earlier, that they were Christ killers and whatnot. But he actually understood that the population knew about all these things too. And he had a visceral hatred for Jews that was racial in nature, and this had come from the 19th century. So when he came to power in 1933, he basically started to convince the German population that the Jews had to be eliminated. And this elimination, again, has a parallel to the church, because the church had tried to eliminate the Jews from their midst for many, many years. The ghettos were just, in essence, an attempt to segregate Jews. So when the war erupted, Hitler basically brought to a practical conclusion what he called the final solution of the Jewish question. And the final solution means exactly that. It's basically the last and final attempt to get rid of the Jews. So the war basically gave him cover and excuse and the means to do horrible things and to kill so many Jews.
But do you think that his purpose aside from his obvious military, shall we say, machinations and his idea of conquering Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But which do you think was cause and which was effect? I mean, the Jews weren't... Wasn't that kind of a handy thing for him?
Of course. The Jews were the scapegoat. They had always been the scapegoat. Even during the Middle Ages, when the Jews were blamed for the Black Plague, which, of course, is a completely baseless accusation, but they were always a convenient scapegoat. And Hitler used them to great effect as a scapegoat. He blamed them for losing the war, the First World War.
Now, how could he blame them for that? How could he blame them for that?
None of these things had to be rational. None of these things had to be based on facts or anything. He blamed them for all kinds of things. He blamed them for the economic depression, because he was convinced that the Jews were behind capitalism. Coincidentally, in contradiction to this also, he believed that the Jews were behind Bolshevism and communism.
He really did believe these things, in other words. He didn't just use it as a convenient ploy to get other people, don't look over here, look over there.
No. They truly believed it. The conception that the German people had of Jews during the Nazi era was completely fantastical. They really had an imagined idea of what the Jews were that had absolutely no basis in reality.
All right, when we come back, I'm going to see if we can expand this outward to the present day, so hold on.
Sure.
303-713-8585, the number, and again, we're talking this hour with Gabriel Wilensky, 6 million crucifixions, as we continue on News Radio 850 KOA. Gabriel doing the honors tonight. 1:45 as we continue. We're talking with Gabriel Wilensky and talking about his work called 6 Million Crucifixions. And let's go to the telephone because Tony anticipated my question on a cell phone. Tony, you're on with Gabriel Walensky. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Gabriel. I was raised a Catholic and have gone to various Christian-oriented churches throughout my life. And in the modern era, pretty much without exception, most of us really believe that that's where our religion came from and hold almost no animosity. There's a few people out there towards the Jewish people. And in lieu of what's going on now, I think, you know, instead of digging up the bad relations with the Christians and the Jews, you know, previously, I think your next book, what's going on with Israel and our current administration, and are you worried about that?
Or our relationship in general.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Because I don't think Christians really hold that much animosity towards Jews anymore.
They don't.
Well, thank you for your question, Tony. Let me actually address this in two different parts. First of all, I think you're right. I mean, Christianity today is, I'm not sure, I don't know how old you are, but if you were raised or you learned about Christianity after 1965, you would have learned something quite different from people prior to that.
Yes, we did. I'm 48.
So in 1965 ended the Second Vatican Council, which officially, the church claimed that the Jews were not, the Jews of the time of Jesus and of all time were not responsible for the death of Christ. This was not the case before. So this particular accusation of deicide had been prevalent in Christianity all the way up until 1965. So the generation that came after was raised in a very different environment. That and other things changed in the Second Vatican Council. The other thing is, in the U.S., the Christianity was also different, and Catholicism in particular was different from Catholicism in Europe in respect to the relationship toward the Jews. As a matter of fact, after the war, actually this was decades after the war, but after the war, the Second World War, the American Catholic bishops were among the first and most important in making a declaration of repentance about the role of Catholicism in fostering antisemitism, which led to the Holocaust. This actually is interesting, particularly vis-a-vis the declaration that the Vatican made, called We Remember. It's a declaration that Pope John Paul II made, in which if you look at one and the other, the contrast is very dramatic. One is very vague and doesn't really say much, whereas what the American Catholic bishops say is quite clear and very, very, very obvious in a way what these bishops were saying, that Catholicism did have a role in creating the environment in which the Holocaust could happen.
Okay, quickly, could I ask your opinion? Aren't you a little bit worried? And I'm a Christian, and I'm extremely worried about the relationship between Israel and the United States at this point. And it's seemingly they're relegated to letting Iran get a nuclear weapon. And Dana Jones has as much as promised to turn Israel into a parking lot. In my opinion, that's why I said this. We're probably talking about your second book. I'm extremely worried that if we don't do anything, if they do get that technology, they're a theocracy enough to go ahead and take care of Israel. And I'm extremely concerned about that. And I was wondering how you felt about that.
I'm totally with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly that this is a major problem, and it cannot be allowed to go much further, because, you know, it's very dangerous. Any religious fundamentalist is dangerous, no matter what persuasion of flavor of religion they have. A fundamentalist, by definition, is dangerous, and Iran is a fundamentalist theocracy, and as such is dangerous. And now, in addition to having an ideology that is dangerous, they have the means and intention of acquiring nuclear weapons, and as you correctly said, you know, they have really bad intentions. As a matter of fact, the president of the country has explicitly said that he would like to wipe Israel off the map.
Are you worried that Netanyahu was snubbed by the administration recently?
Yes, and in addition to that, we have this particular issue that happened very recently here in the U.S. Even though the White House, Axelrod, has officially said, well, you know, we should not really be too concerned about that, that he wasn't really snubbed, you know, that you know, Netanyahu and Obama met as friends, and therefore, and that kind of explains the lack of protocol, if you will, or ceremonial acts or whatnot. And I don't know how much to believe of that, but to be frank with you, I think this particular meeting seemed to be a little bit problematic. But then on the other hand, I know that the U.S. and Israel have a very strong relationship. Israel collaborates enormous amount of intellectual stuff to the U.S., if you will. Lots of American companies have branches in Israel, IBM and Motorola and many others, Intel and so on. And therefore, I think that the ties are very, very strong. The U.S. is not going to let Israel down.
I think the current administration is relegated to allowing them to get nuclear weapons. I don't see them ever doing anything militarily anywhere. They don't even want to do what they're doing now. So I don't see them stop. The only people I see stopping them are Netanyahu, really.
It's very possible. I don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes. I have my suspicion is that there's a lot of activity going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
All right. 303-713-8585, the number, and we're going to take a quick break. And those on the line, please stay right there. Again, we're talking with Gabriel Walensky, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Anti-Semitism Has Led to, certainly the Holocaust. We continue on News Radio 850 KOA. As we head up toward the top, and again, we're talking with Gabriel Walensky, talking about his book, 6 Million Crucifixions, and we have time for only one more call for this hour. Phyllis and Aurora. Phyllis, you're on with Gabriel Walensky. Good morning.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and hi, Gabriel.
Hi.
When I was 5 years old, it was just before World War II started, and I was sitting on the couch, and my mom was cleaning up the living room, and I don't know why I asked this question. Obviously, I had heard something that made me ask it, and I said, Mother, do we like Jews? And she said, My Lord, Phyllis, Christ was a Jew. Of course we like Jews. And so now I ask you, I absolutely love Israel. I want Israel to have a homeland. But is Israel endangering herself by going to build 1,600 more homes? To me, two wrongs don't make a right. And how they've treated the Palestinians, I know I've never traveled there. I'm very sorry that I didn't go to Israel, and I know it's hard to judge until you visit a place. But looking at it, I just think Israel is, you know, making enemies that way, and I don't think that Iran would even be threatening Israel if Israel didn't do some bad things, like you know, whenever that last skirmish they had or war they had.
In Gaza.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Yeah, and by the way, a virtual siege going on. Gabriel, I guess to boil the question down is the politics of Israel at counter with its own best ends?
Well, I think that the population of Israel, if you ask them, are split in this regard. Many people in Israel believe that building the settlements and basically using some of the disputed land that is going in any case when a settlement is done is going to be part of the Palestinian territories is wrong. Therefore, many people oppose the settlements. However, many other people, the religious right in Israel and others who just take a pure legalistic point of view, believe that it's okay to do that because from a legal point of view, from an international law point of view, the territories on which these settlements are being built is disputed land. In other words, there is no legal owner, if you will.
Yeah, okay, I'll tell you what. Hold on, you guys, because we have to take a break to the news, so stay there. We continue on News Radio 850K. It's after 2 o'clock as we head to the second hour of the overnight. We'll rejoin Gabriel Walensky and Phyllis. Don't go away, you guys. We'll get to you in a sec. Coming up at 4 o'clock, Samara Lynn, PC Magazine's business analyst. And she's going to talk about filing your taxes online. She's got some good tips for you to tell you what to do and how to make it work and which one is the better program than another, although she's not there to sell programs, obviously, but she'll say which ones seem to work pretty good. Pros and cons, and even security. A lot of people are worried about that and should be. It'll be coming up at 4 o'clock. Meanwhile, we continue back again. We're talking with Gabriel Walensky, his book, 6 Million Crucifixions. And Phyllis had asked the question, is what the politics of Israel. I think we have to take a view of this as being political rather than what has traditionally been a 19th century view of Israel being Jewish. Rather, this is more political. Wouldn't you agree, Gabriel?
It is absolutely political, and it has become a very nasty situation. But you know, in the Western world, and in particular in the Muslim world, the issue of Israel has become the new anti-Semitism.
Well, you anticipated what I was going to go to, but Phyllis, go ahead and continue. You wanted to get a final read on that about the settlement issue.
Well, the settlement, I think Israel's cutting her own throat, and I think using white phosphorus cut her own throat, and I think Jerusalem is looked at as belonging to the world. And I think Abraham has done a disservice to Christianity, to Judaism, and to Islam. I think if I meet him in the next life, I'll probably smack him. So
what did Abraham do? It's not
Abraham
his fault.
Is the one who set it up that this belongs to you, and that belongs to this one, and that belongs to the other one. And we're still following that after all these years.
Yeah, but David was the one that took Jerusalem.
Oh, is David the one who did it? Well, whoever did it.
Yeah, well, it's important. It's important.
Yeah, it is an important point because, yeah, it was King David that founded Jerusalem.
King David that did it. Okay, then I'll smack him. But anyhow.
But, you know, keep in mind, Phil, is that
all right. But Jerusalem. Israel has got to survive, and I'm not sure she's making doing the right thing, but what do I know? You know, these politicians are smarter. But white phosphorus, not so smart. 1,600 more houses, homes, not so smart. homes with swimming pools full of water when the people down below can't get enough water to run their households. Not so smart. Thank you.
All right, Phil. Yeah, I mean, she brings up what is, in the view of the world, that there's a vast disparity between the Israeli Jews and the Israeli Arabs. And there are Israeli Arabs, obviously.
Yeah, but you also have to keep in mind another thing, and that is the disparity between Israeli Arabs and Arabs outside of Israel.
Yeah, and yeah, Gaza and of course, the West Bank.
But I'm talking about the other places in the Muslim world. I mean, if you compare the quality of life of Israeli Arabs who have freedom of religion, freedom of speech, they can even be members of the parliament in Israel. These kind of freedoms are not available to most Arabs in any other place in the Muslim world. I mean, look to Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, any place in the Muslim world, and you will see that the population there does not have even a fraction of the freedoms that Israeli Arabs have.
No doubt, but we're talking about Palestinians in Israel at the moment. Let me ask you that. You brought up something, and you touched on it. In fact, you almost used the same words I would have used. You said that the anti-Semitism against the Arabs, and obviously you're fully aware that the Arabs are Semites too. Is this a kind of new anti-Semitism?
Well, the hatred that are you referring to, the sort of Islamophobia, you know, the hatred for Arabs? Is that what you're referring to?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't call that anti-Semitism or the new anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a form of hatred that is exclusively directed to Jews. No one ever calls hatred to Arabs or any other group anti-Semitism.
But they are Semites.
They are Semites in the modern understanding of the word Semite. Semite originally was a word that referred to the languages. Of
yeah,
the,
right. A Semitic language. Yeah, it's a language group, and if you go further back, it goes over to Shem. But yeah, I mean, they are Semites.
They are Semites. So, but you know, when you use the term you, meaning the general you, when people use the term anti-Semitism or anti-Semites, they refer to hatred of Jews, not to Arabs.
But there is a hatred of Arabs.
Hatred of Arabs, yeah, for sure. There's hatred of any people, but hatred of Arabs have absolutely no connection whatsoever to this anti-Semitism that we were describing earlier. And this new term that is being used these days called the new anti-Semitism is a different thing. It does not refer to hatred of Arabs. It refers to a new form of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, you know, basically went through three different transformations. The initial one was the theological hatred that we were discussing earlier, the hatred in Christianity, which later morphed into a modern, secular, and pseudoscientific version after the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. And that was the hatred that was common all the way until the Second World War. And these days, we see a new version, you know, that is political. So we went from a theological hatred to a racial hatred to now a political hatred. And this political hatred is basically a politically correct version of anti-Semitism that manifests itself in the form of anti-Zionism. So in polite circles, if you will, people that would normally be anti-Semites of the old school don't do or say things the way anti-Semites of the old school did, but rather they manifest their hatred as anti-Israelism or anti-Zionism. And that is what is now called new anti-Semitism.
Use the word hatred. Is hatred the word that would apply in this situation?
Well, some people do. Yeah, I agree. I think that some people. I mean, of course, there's all kinds of shades of gray, right? I mean, there's people.
There's certainly disagreement. I mean,
of course.
We get that here. I mean, in fact, I do that. You know, the disagreement with political positions and philosophies sometimes take almost to the point of violence. The Lord knows we've seen plenty of it around here lately.
course.
But is hatred? I mean, hatred is such a visceral thing.
Well, yeah, but it can be visceral, but it can be also intellectual. I mean, hatred can manifest itself in many different ways, and there's a wide spectrum of things that happen in the media, in the way Israel is discussed in academia, in government. I mean, as we were discussing a little bit earlier, you know, what happened when Netanyahu came to the U.S. a few days ago. So I don't know if that would qualify as hatred, but certainly there's an element.
Do you think it qualifies as hatred?
No, I don't think that what happened with Netanyahu does. But I wouldn't be surprised if many people in the U.S. Feel that Israel is doing really bad things and it deserves to be treated this way because, you know, they put it in the same bag as all kinds of tyrants or banana republics. So, again, you know, the issue of hatred, I mean, I agree with you, hatred is a very strong word.
Mm.
But I think that the spectrum of the level, if you will, of this animosity goes from, you know, low to hatred, to real hatred.
Do you think the majority of the Western nation states have that same 19th century visceral hatred of the Jews?
No, I don't think so.
Do you think they have that visceral hatred of the Arabs?
No, I think they have a hatred of some certain groups within the Arab community. Certainly, the more fundamentalists are problematic, and people, I don't know if hate them, but certainly fear them and are concerned about them. Of course, some people do hate them, but I don't know if there's a widespread hatred in the sense of anti-Semitism in the 19th century that was widespread. That sort of thing, I don't think exists towards the Arab community.
Hmm. Let's go to the telephone, 303-713-8585, the number. And again, we're talking with Gabriel Walensky, 6 Million Crucifixions. Mark in Oklahoma City. Mark, you're on with Gabriel Walensky.
Good morning.
Hi.
Well, this is the first time I've heard of this book, and I gathered from the interview so far that I get is that you start out, the sweep of the book starts out at the time of Christ and then works its way to the present. Do you essentially stop at the World War II, or do you go up to the present?
Thanks for your call. You probably have not heard of the book before because the book just came out.
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon now. But in essence, the book covers the last 2,000 years of history. It gives a very brief account of anti-Semitism, and then it goes into a deeper sections that discuss the role of the churches during World War II, and then it has another part that makes a study of what happened after World War II. So it goes basically up until the Second Vatican Council and shortly afterwards the teachings of the Church after the Second Vatican Council. So it actually ends with a positive tone because it has that particular positive aspect that the Catholic Church followed by the Protestant churches did, you know, after the Vatican II.
So essentially, you kind of wrap it up along about the Second Vatican Council?
Shortly after.
Well, I can't help but be curious about a certain controversy that happened about 10, 11 years ago where the Anti-Defamation League, I never know if I'm pronouncing this right, is it B'nai B'rith?
Yeah, something like this.
The Jewish Anti-Defamation League did a report called The Religious Right, The Assault on Tolerance and Pluralism in America. And essentially it went after the likes of Pat Robertson and major figures on the American Christian right and connected a lot of dots, which some of the allegations of people therein should not have been connected, and there was a big Flapp and Ralph Reed was dispatched to have a meeting of minds with Abe Foxman, after which essentially there was a truce arrived at, and they stopped harping on it after that. The Anti-Defamation League, as far as challenging the Christian Right, and just as a WASP guy from Oklahoma observing this as an outsider looking in, the impression that I was left with was, even though he had the likes of Pat Robertson calling non-Christians termites that deserved godly fumigation because they undermine all of the basic institutions of American society, and you have a lot of people on the Christian right claiming that America was founded as a Christian nation and that sinister forces have been trying to purge Christians out of the public square, and it depends on how far they want to go is to identify whether the sinister forces are just secular humanists or whether they're Jews. But the upshot is that non-Christians have been out to get Christians in America, so forth and so on. On the other hand, you have these very same people forming organizations like Christian United for Israel and so forth and so on. The concept being is that they fully support Israel because it's part of the big end times plan that Israel needs to be supported, or for whatever reason they support Israel because they have a lot of connections with conservative parties in Israel. So in other words, they're pro-Israel. They can be pro-Israel when it comes to looking across the ocean, but when it comes to here in America, they seem to be, relatively speaking, fairly characterized as anti-Semitic, but they're not characterized by Jewish organizations over here as anti-Semitic, I guess because they want to maintain the support for Israel. What's your take on that?
Well, it's you know, in the case of the Christian right, the Christian right and the evangelicals had a very strong support of Israel. I think that this is a good thing, and I think that the rationale for it, ultimately, as you were saying, has to do with an end times theology. For these Christians, Israel has to be the land populated by the Jewish people, because that's when the second coming is going to happen. So this is the rationale, ultimately, the rationale for the support for Israel. I think there's other reasons too. I think most of these people believe that that's simply the right thing to do, for other reasons beyond the theological reasons.
Well, maybe I should rephrase my question. Whenever certain statements slip out about how that, or maybe not even so ambiguous statements as far as America was founded as a Christian nation, and that non-Christians are out to you know, purge Christianity from the public square, and that the Christian majority is actually a persecuted majority, even though it is the majority in America, because these non-Christians have got the levers of the courts or whatever. And whenever anybody gets any farther past the generalization to specifically pointing at Jews, and then if they're accused of being anti-Semitic over here, they say, well, we're not anti-Semitic because we support Israel. So there's no way, even though we have all this rhetoric about how the Jews are out to undermine us over here in America and infiltrate and secularize every aspect of our institutions and our government, we're not anti-Semitic when we say stuff like that, because in the big picture, we're pro-Israel, so we can't be anti-Semitic and pro-Israel at the same time.
Well, I see, you know, there's several aspects to what you were saying. On the one hand, the founding of the U.S. as a Christian nation, the founders of this nation were not making an explicit statement about the U.S. being a Christian nation. As a matter of fact, they did the opposite of that. They did not want to make the U.S. Of any denomination whatsoever, of any religion whatsoever.
Well, this is ongoing. They just had a thing where the Texas Education Commission, or whatever it is there, has apparently successfully managed to try and purge secular humanism out of the textbooks and to put back, and put in what they regard as what was left out all these many years that America, in fact, was founded as a Christian nation, that all the founding fathers, with the possible exception of Thomas Jefferson, who came up with the diabolical concept of separation of church and state, should be put back in and taught as a fact that America was founded by our founding fathers, who were all obedient Christians as a Christian nation. And there's a guy named Dave Barton who's made a whole cottage industry. I don't know how much income out of Texas is doing these videos, and he's on Christian TV every 4th of July or every Memorial Day going through his spiel about how that there's ample evidence that we were founded as a Christian nation. Anybody who thinks or says that we're not is part of a diabolical plot to secularize all that's right and holy about American society.
Yeah, we get it. We get it. Go ahead, Gabriel.
So, I don't know if you are aware, Mark, but, as I was saying earlier, I am on the camp that don't think that the founding fathers were making the U.S. a Christian nation. I think they explicitly wanted that not to be the case, because that, by definition, excludes other people, and they wanted to be the U.S., an all-including nation.
Yeah, and of course, ultimately, how it has to do with the relationship of the U.S. and Israel, I guess, boils down to which position you take when it comes to religion. And thanks, Mark. We're going to continue on with Gabriel Wilensky, Anti-Semitism Roots and Development, and Where Are Things Now? 6 Million Crucifixions is the name of the book. We continue on News Radio 850 KOA.
Sasha plays with Brit. Adolf builds a bonfire. Enrico plays with it. Whistling tunes, we hide in the dunes by the seaside. Whistling tunes, we're kissing baboons in the jungle. They probably will in games without frontiers, war without tears. If looks could kill, they probably. Andre has a red flag, Chiang Ching's is blue. They all have hills to fly them on, except for Lin Taiyu. Dressing up in costumes, playing silly games. Hiding out in treetops, shouting out rude names.
2:30 as we continue, heading of course toward the top, and another news update at the top. Weather-wise, around Denver right now, we've got 40 degrees, and it's going to get up to, today, it's going to get up into the mid-60s, upper 60s, probably close to 70. And then Tuesday, it's going to get close to 80. So we got some nice weather. It's going to be mostly clear. Right now, we got a full moon tonight. I think it's full. Mostly full, anyway. Which might explain why you can't sleep. But again, 41 degrees, that's downtown. It's about 40 outside our studio as we continue on News Radio 850 KOA. We're talking with Gabriel Wilensky, 6 Million Crucifixions. And David and Edgewood, I think, anticipated yet the next question. And David, you're on with Gabriel Wilensky. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Right.
Gabriel, a thought occurred to me several years ago, and I've never had an opportunity to ask. Is there a group within Israel and probably in the United States that won't see Israel as being consecrated as a nation until the temple is rebuilt? And might this not be what fuels or be at the heart of what fuels the opposition of the Muslim world to Israel itself?
Well, there's opposition on two fronts. On the Jewish side, believe it or not, there's the ultra Orthodox who don't recognize the state of Israel and oppose most of the policies of the state of Israel and don't really participate much on the
on the civic and other arenas in Israel. They don't pay taxes in the same way. They don't go to the army in the same way as most Jews in Israel do. So the ultra-Orthodox oppose the state of Israel on theological grounds because they don't believe that that the state of Israel should exist. And the reason for this is because the state of Israel is a secular state, and these people would like to see a theocracy built in the country.
Go ahead. Because they'd have to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque to be able to rebuild the temple, wouldn't they?
If they actually got their way, yeah, they would do that. I mean, so obviously that's not going to happen, but yes, if they actually had their way, the world would be a much worse place because they would destroy the Al-Aqsa, they would destroy the Omar Mosque, and they would rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount, and that of course would be a horrible, catastrophic event.
It really would be.
It would be. The Israeli government would never allow that to happen, and these people don't really have the power to do that at this point, and hopefully never will. So these people are crazy anyway, because wanting to create a theocracy there is just insane. The world doesn't need another theocracy.
We've got enough as it is.
Exactly.
One more question about Nazi Germany and pre-World War II. You know, it just seems like one more reason not to have a theocracy. Hitler basically cut off his nose to spite his face by ignoring the huge scientific minds, Planck and Einstein and Mach and the whole Planck Institute and the world renown of the Jewish scientists in Germany by disassociating Germany and persecuting those people. He gave Germany no chance to ultimately win. And I don't understand the rationale behind that and being able to turn his back on such scientific genius and giants.
Hitler was a true believer in what he was saying. I mean, his hatred for the Jews was so visceral and so ingrained in him that he could just dismiss Jewish scientists and he called it actually Jewish science, and he was very dismissive of it. And you're right. I mean, scientists of the stature of Albert Einstein, Lise Meitner, and others, Max Planck, by the way, I don't think was Jewish, but many others were, and he dismissed all of them, wholesale, because they were Jews. And I think that this was a good thing. Ultimately, if he had been embracive of them, then the Germans would have probably had the nuclear atomic bomb before the Americans. So,
I'll be getting your book. It's been a very fascinating 2 hours.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Dave. All right.
Bye.
Yeah. Let's get back to the political issue of the moment, because I suppose that when we talk about history and comes as anti-Semitism, we can go back certainly even to the Inquisition in Spain with the Conversos and how that all turned out. But nevertheless, here we are in the present day, and there's clearly a different relationship with Jews than there has been relatively recently, I guess before the Second War, really. But here we are now in a time where the issues that face us, oddly enough, or perhaps not so, that much of the conflict in the world still takes place in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Much of the tension in the world is emanating, it seems, from the Middle East. But the relationship that the West has with Israel is more political than religious.
Totally.
But I wonder, could it possibly devolve back into another time that we recognize, again, the kind of anti-Jewishness? Because I prefer to say anti-Jewish. I know anti-Semitism is the word, but personally I regard Semites as being a large language group. An anti-Jewish movement, do you think that could possibly happen? Or is it going to just continue to evolve into a more political anti-Israeli kind of movement?
But you know, no, no. I think that the anti-Israeli movement today is really a proxy for anti-Judaism. You know, Israel has become a proxy for, quote unquote, the Jew. So I think that the animosity that we see today in the Western world, much of the bias in the media and the attacks on leftist academia and other places, has to do with this animosity towards the Jewish people. And this animosity to the Jewish people, because of the stigma associated with anti-Semitism after the Holocaust, has morphed, as I was saying earlier, into this new sort of politically correct form, which is anti-Israelism.
So you're still convinced that people don't like Jews?
I think so, yeah.
Why?
It's the same reason that has always existed. I mean, if you read in the New Testament, I mean, think about this. The New Testament, just the books of just the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, just those five books have 450 anti-Semitic verses. There's an average of two per page. This has not changed, even after Vatican II. And, of course, it's very hard to change that sort of thing because many Christians believe that that's the Word of God and therefore cannot be changed. But even after Vatican II, with all the very positive movement that has happened in the church, both the Catholic and the Protestant churches, even with all the teachings, the positive teachings towards Jews that happened after Vatican II, you still have in the Catechism and in the New Testament and other books this kind of stuff that doesn't go away. So people of the Christian persuasion that go to church and read the Bible, they still see the Jews addressed in a very derogative or negative way in the New Testament books. You know, when they talk about the Jews did this, the Jews did that, the Jews killed Christ, all this other stuff is still there.
In the New Testament?
In the New Testament. So in the Christian mind, even modern Christians, which are the vast majority of which are open-minded and good-hearted people, they still read this material, and at some level, they have to internalize this problem with the Jews. And I think that this gets also combined with talk at home or talk in other places, gets transformed into this animosity. And I don't want to use the word hatred because, as we were discussing earlier, hatred is a very strong word. So this animosity towards Jews, and this animosity still exists. It has not gone away, but it has transformed itself into something more palatable, something more acceptable to the modern mind, and that is anti-Israelism. Because that is basically, Israel has become a proxy for the Jew, and therefore it's okay to hate Israel because that is not conceived as anti-Semitism. But in reality, it is a camouflaged form of it.
Well, you know, if one generally talks about Israel, and the word Jew hardly ever comes up when you're talking about Israel,
right.
Generally within the U.S. perception of Israel, aside from their political machinations, some of which are not particularly, shall we say, palatable, but they look at Israel as being a strong ally. They look at Israel as being a very important nation in that part of the world, one that we many ways, we believe are more like us. And I, when it comes to talking about Israel as being an entity, There seems to be almost this belief that somehow or other our fates are tied together. And there's never anything that I would call an animosity about certainly not about the Jews. I'm curious why you perceive that somehow or other that we in the West still hate Jews.
I think that you can see it. You can see it everywhere. I mean, just read the press anywhere in the Western world, what they say about Israel, about the policies there, and about what they do.
They say that about our own policies.
No. But they do it. There is no comparison. I mean, it's okay to criticize the policies of any place, and people criticize the policies of all kinds of places, and that's perfectly fine. The problem happens when they
concentrate the criticism, if you will, in one particular place. And if you look at the amount of criticism that Israel receives, you will see that is beyond what any other country receives. There's many places in the world that do all kinds of human rights abuses and so on that don't receive even a fraction of the criticism that Israel receives. Even in the war of Gaza, even in the UN, you can see this thing. The UN is a perfect example of this. I mean, if you actually count the number of resolutions that the UN has passed criticizing Israel, you will see that is overwhelming the number of them that are going against Israel. And when you look at that, you should ask yourself, is Israel really that bad? Do they really deserve to receive much more criticism, many more resolutions at the UN against, let's say, human rights abuses and other things than, for example, Syria? Is this really the case? I mean, if you actually analyze what has transpired in the UN in the last 50 years or so, you will see that there's a very strong bias towards Israel. And the reason for it is because there's as I was saying, this very strong animosity toward Israel. And the reason for it has to do with many things, but one of which is the pressure from the Arab bloc. Obviously, the Arab bloc has an interest in stigmatizing and in demonizing Israel. But on the other hand, the Western world is receptive to this and has accepted the pressure, if you will, to stigmatize and demonize Israel because it holds deep inside this distaste, if you will, for Jews. And I believe that this distaste obeys many reasons, probably, but one of them certainly has to do with the upbringing that many people has had or they have heard from their teachers or parents, and has to do with a theology that we were discussing earlier, that Jews were problematic and they were hateful and so on. So this has not gone away, unfortunately. It has gone under the radar for many years after the Holocaust because it was taboo to talk negatively about Jews after the Holocaust. But now the cat is out of the bag, so to speak, and people are freely speaking negatively about it again. In the U.S., this is actually not so problematic, but in Europe, this is very, very problematic. And in Europe, there's a huge amount of anti-Semitic acts, even violent acts, that are unheard of here in the U.S., but in Europe, it's actually not uncommon at all.
Well, I know that the Europeans are having an awful lot of problem with their Muslim population right now. Germany has got Turks. They don't know what to do. The French have got Arabs, mostly from North Africa. I mean, every time you turn around, there's another riot somewhere in Paris.
Yes. Well, France has, at this time, 10% of the population is Muslim.
Yeah, and to me, I don't see any problems with the Jewish population. I certainly don't read about any issues concerning how the Europeans are responding to Jews. I do know how they feel and how they're reacting to the Muslim populations there. And the English think that they're losing their country to Muslims.
Yes, but the English are also quite critical of Israel and the Jews.
Well, I think they're critical of a political, what they perceive as being a political, shall we say, direction that Israel is taking in the wrong direction. But I don't think they're critical of the Jews. Certainly, when it comes to the kind of radical Islam movements within, say, particularly in say, France, the French... You know, they talk about the Muslims. They don't talk about the Jews.
Sure. No, I agree with you, and that's why I was saying earlier. This animosity is not directed towards the Jews in general as an ethnic or cultural group. It's directed towards Israel. But again, this is a proxy. In other words, they are replacing one for the other. In other words,
if Western nations disagree with the political designs or decisions and policies of Israel, that really it's not a disagreement about their policies with the government. It's because they hate Jews.
No. That's not what I'm saying. And I'm also not saying that it's not okay to criticize Israel. What I'm saying is that the amount of criticism that is leveled against Israel is it goes beyond a normal measure. I mean, people in many countries of the world, of the Western world, criticize Israel in ways that go beyond what they criticize other nations when they do similar things. For instance, when Israel defends itself from rocket attacks in the south of Israel from that comes from Gaza, people in the Western world tend to complain about the use of force and that Israel defended itself by attacking a house or whatever in the Gaza Strip.
Well, I've seen some of the reports that came out of what happened in Gaza last year. It wasn't just a couple of houses.
No, that was a war, right? So, the interesting thing about it is if you look at what the Israeli army did there, they actually went out of their way to try to protect civilians, even though there was devastation, as it is, the case with any war. But the army there went out of their way to try to minimize collateral damage, and that is actually something that is not reported as much as it should in the Western media.
We're going to take a break. 303-713-8585, the number. Gabriel Walensky with us. 6 Million Crucifixions, the name of the book, Anti-Semitism Roots and Development, and Where Are We Now? We continue. 303-713-8585, the number. I'm Rick Barber. You're listening to News Radio 850 KOA. As we head up toward the top, and again, we're talking with Gabriel Walensky, talking about his book, 6 Million Crucifixions, 303-713-8585, the number, and on a cell phone is Salim. Salim, you're on with Gabriel Walensky. Good morning.
How are you guys?
Good.
How are you, Gabriel? Hey, I'm not trying to, I'm a U.S. citizen, I'm a Muslim living here, I love it, it's great, but let me, I want to tell your guest, he's talking about how Israel, basically the UN had like 50 resolutions against them. Well, Israel also has given the middle finger to the UN for just as that many resolutions that they basically said, the hell with you, So another thing is that just very recently, Haaretz, one of the newspapers over there, just did a poll. 85% of Israelis want peace with the Palestinians, but unfortunately, the government is just so corrupt with money, and they know they're not going to, once there is peace over there, they know they're not going to get that welfare check from us, the United States, that $10 billion in these. Then these politicians over there, like Netanyahu and whatever his name is, and all these other, their family trees are not going to be fed anymore, and there's going to be peace. People forget that in 1917, Palestinians and Jewish people used to eat in the same table. Now they can't even live in the same city. That's just, I mean, sir, you're a little bit ingenuous about your information. Israel has basically told the UN over 53 resolutions should just take a hike, So, there's tremendous. Last year on the Gaza Strip, the pictures that CNN and Fox and all these people are not showing you, the Muslim world saw what Israel did to a population that, had absolutely nothing to, So you're a little bit ingenuous about your information there, sir. Nobody, 85% of people over there do want peace, but unfortunately, money overrules everything else, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Let me first of all, let me say one thing. I am not here as an advocate of Israel. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Israeli people. So the one thing I can tell you as an observer from outside is that the large number of UN resolutions that were ignored, if you will, by Israel, were ignored for obvious reasons, because these were unfair resolutions that had absolutely there was no reason to respect them. They were clearly politically motivated and pushed through this system by the majority of the Arab bloc, which actually constituted many, many votes in the UN General Assembly. Now, in regards to the other point that you were making, in Israel, I agree with you that most of the population, I don't know if 85% is the number, but I think that the vast majority of Israelis, probably larger than 85, want peace with Palestinians, and would be very happy to come to compromises with them and relinquish land. As you probably know, Israel has always, as a matter of fact, even before it was Israel, before the foundation of the state in 1948, the Jewish settlers there were very willing to coexist with the native Arab population and share the land. And only later things started to become really nasty, and then they became separate, as you were saying, that they cannot even share the table anymore. But to this day, I think that most of the population in Israel would be very happy to establish a Palestinian state and have peace and have prosperity for both peoples. The problem is that they're fundamentalist people. They're radicals on both sides of the fence that don't want this. There's many reasons why many people on the radical right in Israel don't want it, and many people on the radical side, on the Arab side, don't want it either. And this actually is the reason why there's no peace there at this time.
All right. Your book is available on the bookstands and on the .coms, is it?
It's available everywhere. You can get it from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble online.
All right.
For anybody that wants more information, the website is 6millioncrucifixions.com.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, Gabriel Walensky, thank you so much. Good luck with your work.
Thank you.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Good night.
And we're going to take it up to the news, find out what's going on out there, and then we'll come back. And we have the new poll up. Speaking of religion, you're going to find this interesting, I'm sure. So stick around. 303-713-8585, the number. I'm Rick Barber. You're listening to News Radio 850 KOA.